This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at the Resnick Group. And before joining the Resnick Group, Ken, you had an illustrious career in the federal government. You were IG at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and also was a member of the Secret Service. So, and we're going to talk about all those things. So, first of all, welcome to the show, Ken.
Well, thanks, Roger, for having us. I'm really looking forward to getting a chance to chat for a while here.
And one of the things that sort of intrigued me and that I wanted to hear about a little bit is some of your work to start the show when you were with the Secret Service. And I understand you were on the security detail for President Reagan for a number of years, and I'm sure you have some stories there and experiences, and I just want to give you a chance to reflect on those a little bit for us, audience.
It really was a great career. It was 21 years. It scoped with regard to investigations. Protective intelligence was generally my footprint. I worked closely with the CIA and the FBI and NSA, but I did do a small stick with the President's Detail, President Ronald Reagan. And we, as we mentioned offline a minute ago, before when I first got over to the detail in 1984, you might recall President Reagan was on his way to Kansas City for the significant debate with Walter Mondale.
I remember that. Yeah, I'm that old.
You remember the tone of that was the fact that he didn't do well that night. He might lose the election, which of course turned out to be the case. But a particular night at hand, this particular evening, I happen to be up on the second floor, coming down the elevator with the President and First Lady. And at which point the President had a tremendous sense of humor. And I thought myself, can you imagine going in this debate and probably 90 million people listen to it? And what he did is he looked over me and he said to me, you're new in the detail. I said, yes, sir. He says, well, how about you go back and do the debate this evening and I'll be the Secret Service agent. He says, you know, I played that in a movie Once Upon a Time. And I thought to myself for a moment, here I am, some kid from New York City talking to the President of the United States privately. And, of course, I had to come back with my Irish ancestry. I had to come back with some answer. And I came back and said, Mr. President, I think it's best that we keep it just the way it is. You do the bait, and I'll be the agent tonight. We all laughed. And what he did is he taught me the importance of laughter, humor, and oneself.
Right. Was that the debate where he made the comment about Walter Mondale's youth and inexperience?
That's right. That was a great moment. I think that
turned it all around.
Did. Right. It sure did.
Right. You also were the Inspector General at HUD, as I mentioned in the opening. Mm-hmm. And can you talk a little bit about, you know, your role there and what you were responsible for and what you were looking at as the Inspector General?
Well, Roger, it's interesting when you mentioned Secret Service and Inspector General. That's quite a jump from one to the other, a little bit different discipline.
Yep.
But when I left the Secret Service, I went to this thing called the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was the overseer of the savings and loan crisis. And I was the assistant director of investigations. We kind of stood that back up, open offices, and we had some significant noted cases like Michael Milken and David Paul and Whitewater investigation. Whitewater,
yeah.
Too,
yeah.
You know. And so that kind of prepped me for it. And then when I came into the IG's office, I had no intentions of going back in government service, but when after 9/11, that certainly changed the entire dynamic. So I accepted the position. It was a big office. We had about 750 to 800 people, agents and special agents and auditors, 44 offices across the country, and a budget of about $125 million.
Wow, that's I worked at, as we talked before the show, I worked at GSA, and the GSA IG's office isn't quite that large. I mean, it's a great office and does a lot of good work, but that's a big office to manage. It must have been a big change for you.
A big shop. The focus of a lot of the work was, of course, oversight of HUD's expenditures of funds, which has to do with 2,700 public housing programs, community development grant money, disaster relief money, and of course the other two, which became so prominent in 2004 and 2005, was FHA and Ginnie Mae.
Right, and while you were at HUD, I guess you were also served on the Federal Task Force for Operation Stolen Dreams. Can you talk a bit about what that was and what the goals of that?
I did. The chairs of that was Bob Mueller, the FBI director, and Eric Holder. When the new administration came back in, the focus was to create policy and procedures that work closely with the state and state IGs, the state attorney generals, in a common forum, and also the regulatory agencies and all the federal law enforcement agencies. So we're all talking collectively together to focus on one primary mission, that was mortgage fraud.
Right. Can you give us some examples of some of the things that you saw
we
or
did.
You uncovered and dealt with?
What we wanted to do, we wanted to make sure we were pursuing these investigations aggressively, making sure the U.S. Attorney's Office were focusing on these cases when they're presented by federal law enforcement agencies, be it FBI or Secret Service or the IG's offices. And when we saw a host of different fraud activities, a sample example of one would be we had a major matter out of Southwest United States where you had a host of spec development, spec residences on a development, new development. And what had happened was the developer had built these houses. And what would happen is an illegal immigrant maybe going into a 7-Eleven to get a cup of coffee one morning would be met by a gentleman that spoke Spanish and asked him, engaged him as far as his family and where he's living and how much he's paying for rent. And this young man might say, well, I'm paying $800 of rent. And this guy came back and said, well, listen, how about getting into a 3-bedroom, 2-car garage, new house at $600 a month? And of course, he was astonished by such an offering. I'm here illegally. I don't have a job. I have no means of income. Don't worry about it. Show up tomorrow with your wife and family and still work out the paperwork. That precipitated an FHA loan, in which substantial amount of fees were added onto the back end of that loan. And what you had is a loan, maybe typically $150,000 mortgage. Now it's $167,000 mortgage, and one after the other after the other. And, of course, those were teaser mortgages, no down payment mortgages, and the rest. And, of course, we know what happened. These houses, after a year or so, the people left them, and these developments were left abandoned in many parts of the country.
Right, and then, we, sort of the taxpayer, right, left to pick up the bill?
It was FHA mortgages. They're FHA insured. That means the taxpayers will bail that out eventually.
Yeah. And when did you come to Resnick Group? How long has it been?
October of 2010.
Okay. Can you give the listeners a little bit of an overview of Resnick and what you guys do?
Absolutely. Sure. I came to learn of Resnick. They're an accounting firm. Now a big 20 accounting firm as they talk, a national accounting firm. Very active in the housing market, disaster relief market. They do a lot of work now in government practices, and I'll speak to you a little bit about that. And most recently, which is really exciting, is they just merged with a company out of New York City called J.H. Cohen. It's been in business for 85 years. It's about the similar size. And as that merger has occurred, it's gone now from Big 20 to probably a Big 9 or 10 accounting firm in the country. They bring a different practice. Most of their practice in the Northeast United States, really, really focused on New York, New Jersey. Ours, on the other hand, is nationwide. So the focus and the relationship is significant.
Okay. And how does that I've got a good question, though, but how does that work now? You've got all these Yankee fans and you got the National fans and Mets fans. And, how does that work in that dynamic?
Well, even though Roger got accused of being Northeastern from Massachusetts, but I'm a born and bred New York kid. So I'm going to favor my Giants easy, but particularly my Jets and the like. I can't get away from my New York Jets.
Well, Ken, I hate to tell you, I'm a big Patriots fan. So so the more the Jets suffer, the better I feel.
Either way, we'll fill the stadium every time they play.
That's right. So how, and I think you've touched a little bit about this, how is this merger between Cohen Group and Resnick, how is that going to benefit your collective clients?
Well, I think it's fantastic. I come out of, I'm one of the principal senior advisors in the government practice within Resnick. And as it stands, we do a lot of our business with government agencies, state agencies, and the like. And what's happened, this complements J.H. Cohen because they have a significant consultant practice as well. But what we'll have a chance to do is work with them and their clients up in the Northeast United States. And you know, in this business, unless you have a prominent role in the New York metropolitan area, New Jersey, Connecticut, you're missing out. So this collaboration, in turn, they now have a significant footprint in Washington, D.C. and other points throughout the United States. So it's really a perfect match. There's no conflict with regard to our clients. In fact, we complement each other. Sure. And I think it's quite exciting.
It's a wonderful merger. And, it's a great opportunity, it sounds like, for Resonate Group as well. Right now, we do have to take a break, Ken, but when we come back, we'll be talking more with Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at Resonate Group, and we'll talk a little bit more about transparency, reporting, accountability, what that means for the federal government, what it means for contractors and just industry in large. And later in the show, we'll get into a little bit about the mortgage crisis and Ken's experience and background in dealing with that when he was with government. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at the Resonate Group, an accounting firm that focuses here in Washington on supporting government and also supporting those who interface with the government as well. And Ken, when we took the break, we were talking a little bit about what the Resonate Group does in terms of its support. But I want to turn the clock back a little bit and talk a bit more about your government service. And I know one of the things that actually led you to eventually coming to the Resonate Group is a lot of work that you did in recovery support on Hurricane Katrina. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. The event that precedes that event was the post after 9/11 disaster in New York and Washington, D.C. HUD had a big impact with regard to that, and we approached that matter as well, because my feeling was in the Lower Manhattan redevelopment was to be proactive rather than reactive from a standpoint of Inspector General. One of the things I think we fail at is being proactive to prevent the problem from happening to begin with. Having said that, we translated that sort of discipline into disasters, the greatest natural disaster of our time, Katrina and Wilma.
Yeah, Ken, just to interrupt that, can you talk a little bit of what the HUD did in regard to 9/11? One of the things that I learned is that IGs and inspectors across government played a role in helping, sort of investigate the that event.
Yeah, well, first of all, my office in New York was destroyed. It was tariff, Customs House Tariff 5. It went down in the disaster. Thank God I didn't lose any loss of life as a result of it. But what happened was we immediately became engaged because our relationship with the enforcement, local, state, and federal agencies. An arduous task. It was a very difficult, challenging task, and our folks did a great job. But one of the things we did is it was such a passionate matter, I think, that fraud could be committed against New Yorkers after 9/11. What we did is we did two things. I sent auditors right into the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation, hands-on, proactively, and looked and monitored the disbursement of these funds as we're going back out. Let me give an example. What happened was some of the businesses downtown New York City were going back and self-reporting their losses the prior year. And so what happened is it was a little honor system. Now, being a good New Yorker that I am, I like to trust but verify.
Right.
And
right.
So we
so
did.
So President Reagan liked to do that too.
So we did is we came back and we went back and looked at the documentation, and we went back and looked at the tax returns of the previous years and found out there was discrepancies. You wouldn't believe it, but some people actually went and docked their tax
returns. I'm shocked, right?
So we did that. I think we stopped some of that. LM Loan Manhattan Development Corporation did not feel comfortable. It's not comfortable having an IG auditor sitting alongside
sure.
you. But they accepted. I think we saved a lot of money. On the investigation side, we teamed up with the Department of Justice, U.S. Attorney's Office, and we announced zero tolerance. You commit fraud in this matter. I don't care what the dollar amount is. We're going to prosecute these cases. And I believe we really had a great success in trying to prevent much of this from happening. We went back and translated that discipline in the Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas disaster following Katrina and Wilma.
Go ahead.
And that's how I got to know Resnick. Resnick was very active in contract dispersing funds in the Mississippi area. And so I got to know them. I opened a bunch of offices down there in Mississippi, Louisiana. They worked with Resnick and other firms as well. And the best part about it is my concern was, would they let us know when they saw anomalies? And they did. And so we were able to pursue those cases, to order those matters, and try and deal with them on a very proactive, timely basis.
Yeah, and let's get back to you for just a second. In your role right now and your interface and supporting government with Resnick Group, what are you exactly doing to support, and how has your past experience helping you in delivering those that support?
Well, I think these companies like Resnick or these other companies is always challenged as to what relationship they're going to have with the overseers or their government agencies. And it's always at times, I guess I'm going to be careful to use the word frightening at times, because, you know, it's like dealing with a lion, you know, and sometimes it's seen that way. And I in my opinion, now crossing over to the other side from the overseer to person being oversaw, mm-hmm. is that you have to work. There has to be some common ground to work collectively in real time to prevent issues from happening.
Right. And what do you think what was the biggest surprise or eye-opener when you went from, like you say, that's a great way to put it, like being the regulator to being the regulated? What surprised you the most or was new to you that you said, hey, wow, that's...
Well, I think it comes down to regulation. I mean, what's enough? You know, I mean, I think the pendulum swims both ways. And I think, quite frankly, I think I saw in the SNL days, there was very little regulation on the SNL crisis. And I think we got in problems with that. I think it's be argued, it could be said that much of what happened in the mortgage industry was lack of regulation. On the other hand, you know, do you now overregulate and task the industry unfairly at enormous cost to go back and ply with sometimes frivolous matters that have no bearing in the outcome of the execution of the contract? So, you know, there is a play, and I think the only way to work this out is common sense minds sitting down discussing both sides of the issue and opening up dialogue as a result of it. There is no one answer. It's often not congressional policy and bills that are passed. Sometimes they're obstructed in a way. I think it comes down to common sense sometimes.
Yeah, and I have sort of a similar, you know, background in terms of working in government and, you know, writing regulations and then going outside and sort of advising mm-hmm. companies who were being regulated in the procurement world. And really hit the nail that a hammer on the I'll fix that when we retape, okay, so we can keep going, and they'll fix it. But so I think you've got a great point there when you talked about common sense and not one size fits all, and they're figuring out what the right solutions are, because you really it's almost like trying to, you know, thread the needle when you try to write regulations that, you know, provide the enforcement necessary but also do not, you know, unnecessarily burden the private sector, so the private sector can actually do what the government wants it to do. You know, with that regard, one of the things I wanted to turn to and get your take on is, you know, the mortgage crisis mm-hmm. and what we've gone through. And I guess my first question is, it seems like this happens every 10 years or so, mm-hmm. something along these lines. You mentioned, you know, your work with the Resolution Trust Company. You know, we have the current, you know, the Great Recession and the, you know, and the mortgage crisis behind that. Why does it seem like, you know, these things keep happening? Is there, well, go back to the regulation? What is it?
Yeah,
is it just human nature?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I mean, about human behavior. I think that, the mortgage industry, the housing market, came as close as you possibly can to collapsing our entire industry. I think everyone agrees that that is as close as you can come to having happen. And we're still feeling the effect that we will for the days to come. The question is, what happened? I mean, you have a lot of people talking about Wall Street and the rating agencies, and there's certainly reason to believe there's a feeding frenzy with regard to much of this activity. I mean, the good Senator Bond on the Appropriations Committee used to say, it's hard to have a mortgage industry where there's no skin in the game. You got to have something down. They set up mortgages that had no down payments, zero down payments, interest-only payments, and so on and so forth. Then I think the consumer has some role here. I mean, most of the consumers were victims, but there were those, and we found investigations that falsified Social Security numbers, falsified their tax returns, falsified their income earnings to qualify. Now, are they complicitous, or is it the lender that was telling them to do that? Well, in my business, that's a conspiracy.
Right. That's both. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
So, I mean, you know, the question is, are they complicitous too? And then finally, what you have is the legislative branch. I mean, were they involved in this? I think you'd agree that we had a very active lobbyist program that was coming out of Fannie and Freddie. We had a great example of Countrywide that was bought up by Bank of America. Angelo Masullo made, $500 million in 4 years as a chairman. And he had a program where he was going back and giving special preference mortgage out to congressional staffers, to congressmen, to the people of the executive branch to give them favorable mortgage programs. In fact, there was a report that Congressman Issa just put out the early part of this month that speaks to this very issue. Is that right? And I think people have to ask themselves that question. Does that kind of influence, does it impact, or did it, more importantly? Maybe there wasn't a quid pro quo, but the fact of the matter is, did that kind of activity stop the pursuit of ending this activity at the expense of estimated to be, by 2014, over $300 billion that would be spent out in bailing out Fannie and Freddie?
Yeah.
It's a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is. It seems to me when you put those, there's a question of trust there, right? When you're talking about that and Countrywide and what was going on.
I refer to it as crisis of confidence. I mean, you know, people, when they start to doubt our legislators and the fact is, are they representing them well? There's so many good people in government. There's so many wonderful, hardworking people in government service, in the executive, legislation, and judicial branch that come every day and work very hard. But there are some that, for some reason, as you're getting back to the personality issues, some people feel entitled.
Right.
And I mean, that's I'm sure if we went and asked our good friends at the FBI Behavioral Science Unit, they got some very strong opinions about this matter at hand. But I think the only way to deal with it is you deal with a case-by-case basis. Try and have transparency, try and have some good oversight, reasonableness to the industry, and I think that collectively seems to work out.
Right. And right now, Ken, we do have to take a break, but when we return, we'll be talking more with Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at the Resonate Group, and we'll talk a little bit about transparency and the compliance challenges facing the government. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, we are talking to Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at the Resonate Group. And, you know, Ken, when we took a break, we were talking a little bit about, the role of regulation and the balance between being the regulators and those being regulated and how you make and you use the common sense approach to it. Just sort of taking a step back from that and sort of setting the table, like what are the requirements, so to speak, is from your perspective, what are, in terms of compliance and fraud, waste, and abuse, what are the biggest challenges that you see in your area that the government is facing?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's almost when you think of, it's so cliche to say waste, fraud, and abuse, but almost each of those have to be taken individually, and yet they has a relationship between them as well. I mean, I think, for example, I know as an IG, we got about 27,000 referrals at our hotline each year. I mean, can you imagine departments like DOD and whatever else? So how do you deal with that volume of programs? So let's assume I was recently asked about what do you do in a hypothetical matter if something comes to your attention and some concern, and it might be resolved effectively in a matter of, let's say, waste by just calling up a senior official in the department and saying, listen, I just got told about this matter at hand, and maybe it's something. Just bringing the focus to it might resolve that issue. Yeah. Huh? Then the question is, comes down to as far as abuse. I mean, that's more significant. And to what level, to how much dollar amount is involved as a result of that thing? I think what happens is companies that are dealing in business with the government, in all honesty, I think sometimes they're in their pursuit of trying to get these contracts and dealing with 8A firms or whatever else, they go back and make an offering to something that necessarily is not what the government wants. I sometimes think the government's not sure at times what they want. And it changes. It morphs all the time as a result of it. And that makes it difficult for contractors to provide the services when these things are changing on a regular basis. The last part of that is the fraud. I mean, fraud is clear. I mean, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. It's very, you know, I put it this way, you know when you see it. Right. And when you get into that kind of arena, then you got something quite serious, and then you have to deal with those matters. And that is the most critical, I think, important realm of the inspector general is to look at that fraud and adjudicate it. And by the way, sometimes, you know, and I think contractors get really nervous, you know, if it's like the only thing, if you haven't done anything wrong, you shouldn't be concerned about it. So I used to tell my staff, when you go out and talk to those contractors, government agencies, go out with the idea in mind. Listen, you're just trying to develop facts. You know, no predisposition with regard to it. And I think, you know, I think the cue is for the contractors, the government agencies, to respond to those questions and lay out the facts as they deem, and just let the chips lie where they lie.
Along those lines, one of the things that's the big buzzword today or watchword in government is transparency, and the role transparency plays in preventing fraud, waste, and abuse. Mm-hmm. Or making sure the government's like operating, you know, consistent with its, you know, authorities and that sort of thing. What are your thoughts about transparency and its role?
Well, I tell you, I'm one of the things I did learn in my stick at the Inspector General's office is transparency is the key. I mean, it has to be a reasonable oversight, but it has to be transparent, open-ended. There's no reason in the world, unless there's some classified programs involved, that this can't be put out in front so that everybody knows, shines a light on the issues at hand that they're dealing with. I think it prevents firms from getting in sort of problems. I think it certainly allows the government. I think sometimes, listen, these government agencies are run by politicians. And, I mean, they have friends. And, I mean, one of the notions is when somebody runs for office and a corporation or somebody is giving this enormous amount of money to those campaigns, they expect something in return. So what do you do to prevent that from happening? The cue is you have to force transparency. And transparency comes from the top down. It's all about leadership. If the leadership is not presenting that on a regular basis, it's not going to work. You know, as we've seen witnesses of that, I think you a comment about what some of the stuff Brian Miller at the GSA IG was faced with in his recent testimony in the GSA scandal in Las Vegas.
Yeah. With regard to transparency, I'm curious about your thoughts about that balance between, you mentioned like national security issues, but, mm-hmm. you know, recognizing the legitimate sort of, you know, proprietary rights to data that companies have, and not having that kind of information disclosed. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I mean, I think so. I mean, that's why these companies have general counsels to go back and review those matters. It's key to have those general counsel to be able to make sure that their client, their focus, their industry or their company is not being adversely affected by releasing information. But my experience has been those things can be worked out. I mean, they typically can be. I think there's a spirit to work them back out. What I see is you get a notion of when you see such roadblocks that are being thrown up in front of you, you start to, I mean, you can't but help but be suspicious with regard to the matter at hand. And I saw that in the mortgage industry. You know, that became evident that there was reasons and why. Well, in my opinion, I think it was done because there was shenanigans going on. There was wrongdoing going on. And as long as they could delay it, the more profitability that would come to the industry. Right. The end result is look what happened.
Yeah. Well, you brought up the mortgage industry again, and you know, so I'm going to ask you, what does the market look like today from your perspective?
Well, I think I was just down a major event with the Mortgage Bankers Association, and I must tell you, when I was asked to comment about it, I stood up and sort of apologized to these senior officials, telling them if I prosecute any of them or audit any of them, I apologize. That was my job. I work for the American taxpayer. But the reality is they have a crisis of confidence right now. I mean, and the bottom line, their client is the consumer. And the consumer's lost faith. At right now, and one of the folks had said that if you had a cocktail party at your house, I don't know if you'd want to necessarily come back and say, well, I'm a mortgage broker. I mean, I think people would sort of kind of step away from you a little bit. But at this point, there's a challenge. And their client, their goal, their intention is to be able to provide affordable mortgages to those people. The housing industry is key to our society. And until that comes back, our economy will be adversely affected as a result of it.
Right. And where we are today is, as you mentioned, it was so close to just completely and utterly imploding, you know, the economy. Can you talk a little bit from your perspective what you saw as in the handling of its successes and or failures, or where things could still be improved?
Oh, yeah. I think some industry people have, it's been a wake-up call. You know, what do they say, that denial is not a river in Egypt, huh?
Right.
I mean, the reality is the fact that they got to face up to
what... You are from New York.
They got to face up to what happened. And I mean, they lost business. A lot of people lost their jobs as a result of this thing. But I think the days ahead, I think they're challenged by it. The other thing that I think they have to do from an industry standpoint is mitigate what has happened. I mean, it makes sense. I think you saw a settlement that just came out. I think it was spearheaded by Secretary Donovan and Eric Holder, and in a settlement, a $35 billion settlement with the industry. That's a lot of bees. And I think what they're faced with now is, how do they now get past that and mitigate some of the challenges they're faced with? I think they're trying to. I mean, based on what I've seen so far, but they have a long way to go. You know, I envision the days of zero down payment, no down payment going by the way for a long time, getting back to what we used to think in traditional ways, FHA, 15, 20% down, a good FICO scores, permanent job, whatever else. And I think, you know, again, I think that has to be the case. I think the industry will tolerate nothing less.
Yeah, along those lines, it does. I mean, it's getting through this part of it, like, you know, what you... Your discussion sort of made me think about Countrywide and Bank of America and how much they've had to pay or lost as a result of that acquisition, and trying to get past that as well.
Sure. I think, and you know, the fact is, you know, we almost talk about Countrywide or Bank of America as something abstract, as something far.
Yeah.
They make their money off consumers. I mean, at the end of the day, we're paying one way or the other. And these situations that come about as a result of it. I mean, Angelo Mazzullo, the president of Countrywide, I think his settlement was $56 million that he has to pay out in final resolution this matter. But, I mean, when you think about, I believe that they were the largest mortgage holder in the United States, and what you're thinking in terms of Fannie and Freddie paying out by 2014 over $300 billion of tax dollars, that's a big difference. And it's really a kind of sad commentary. But I think it's like anything else, it's going to take some time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, right now we have to take some time for our last break, Ken. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at the Resonant Group, and we'll talk a bit about some lessons learned and past experiences over your career, where you see things headed just generally in the compliance and audit world. And, you know, I may give you a chance to just, if you were king for the day, what would you change or fix? You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Ken Donahue. Ken is a principal and senior advisor at the Resonant Group. And, you know, Ken, just to continue this conversation a little bit about the mortgage market before we talk about some lessons learned and just big picture things. And maybe this is actually a big picture thing because they're a pretty big organization. Fannie and Freddie, what do you see happening there, or how is that going to? Is it just again, like you said, a matter of time to rebuild confidence in those organizations, or?
Well, I'll tell you, they are both. I believe both chairmen are in the process of leaving. Holeman at Freddie Mac and Mike Williams up at Fannie Mae, which I've had a chance to sit down and meet with both of them. I think it's a tough challenge because what happened is you might know Fannie and Freddie were the love child of Washington D.C. up until a few years ago, and these gentlemen now and others are trying to keep this thing together, keep the lights on, keep it running because it's a big job and a very important job when you think of how many people, how many mortgages rely upon the support of an organization like Freddie and Fannie. So it seems to me very paramount, and I think it's very important. I think it's probably one of the biggest challenges the legislative branch is going to have in what they decide to do in the restructure reorganization of these mortgage programs.
Right. It's fun. It's, you know, I mean, when you talk about the importance of the housing market, the economy, I mean, within that context, right, there's no more important entities in Freddie and Fannie, right? I mean, it's going to be a big deal.
I think it's, you know, listen, the home ownership in this country is the greatest thing we have. I mean, it sort of defines our country as a free society and the gift of having home ownership everyone dreams for. It's not possible without mortgages. It's not possible without some sort of a support mechanism to manage those mortgages and sort of guarantee them. I mean, I think the FHA guarantees a full faith and credit. Fannie and Freddie's a little bit of an anomaly and a little bit different. But I think the days ahead, they're going to have to go back and weigh into this matter at hand. And quite frankly, in my experience of being out in the industry now, many of the men and women in Fannie and Freddie are accomplished people, have done a fine job, and try and do the best they can to ensure that this stuff continues.
From your perspective, now let's just turn to some sort of big picture or lessons learned. And, what lessons do you take from, you know, the mortgage crisis? What would you, if you were king for the day or could do one thing, what would that lesson be, and how would you respond?
Wow, that's a king for a day. That makes me nervous. It's not my nature. I like to think when I was IG, when I used to show up in the morning, I used to sit down and say to myself, Ken, who do you really work for? Do you work for the president? Do you work for the administration, Congress, whatever else? And I used to always remind myself, maybe that's because of my heritage, and I always work for the American taxpayer. I mean, that's the one we have to focus on. It's those people that are in need, those people that are trying to maintain and have family and send their children to school, that they feel comfortable when they have a home and they can make those mortgage payments. I feel so sad for some of those people that have lost homes most recently, and the idea of how it humiliating it can be, people losing their job, to be left out and have to give up their very prized ownership of their home. So as to your question at hand, what would I do? And I think,
I'm just, you know, I'm just thinking about it. So you're working on behalf of the American taxpayer right now, just putting that hat on again, in terms of, and you've talked a lot about the crisis of confidence and restoring that confidence. Is there one or two things that you see could be done to further restore that confidence?
Well, I do. I mean, I think that it's, you know, the blame game doesn't work. I mean, I think we're past that phase. I think now it's a question of what do we do now to address this? And I think everybody has a piece of this. The industry, as I said to you before, has to go back and mitigate some of the issues at hand. How do they address these matters? I mean, they have to help homeowners. I mean, they have to, you know, if they can do to try and keep them in their houses, facilitate the mortgages, recreate, they got to be responsive. I mean, listen, they got to answer the phone when people call. I mean, that was a challenge up until the past year or so. I mean, it's such enormous volume. You have enormous amount of houses on the market right now that are occupied. And I think they're trying to figure out best way to sell those. I do believe in my SNL days, the government should not be involved in holding homes. I think the best thing to do is get that out to the industry. Yes, they may get a discount in buying some of those houses, but the best part about it, they'll get it and they'll sell it off. They'll recreate the house and sell it to somebody that was more than happy to buy those houses. So the inventory is important. Get it out. It has an adverse effect on the real estate market short term, but long term is the best way to get that out to the people that need those homes. And besides, again, government does some things very well, does a lot of things that should stay out of the business in the hand. And so I think it's the people in the industry that know this stuff, and the best way to do this, go back and let business decisions go back and let them work the market out.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, there's an economic incentive to to repackage or refinance whatever these homes and get them out and get them sold. And I don't think that same economic incentive is if the government's holding it. Just doesn't work. Just fundamentally doesn't work the same way. But about the government, I think, one of the things going forward that I'd be interested in your thoughts are, that I know the listeners would as well, is as we face, the budget cuts and budget pressures over the next few years, how do you see those smaller budgets affecting the government's ability to monitor, these kind of compliance issues, whether it's in any financial market? I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
I think that's a great question. I mean, I think we're in a stage of shrinking government, and as a result of that, everybody's going to be affected by it, being defense, as we know, the major cutbacks, but particularly in my world as well. So, listen, did we bloat ourselves? I tend to think, as a former IG, I think we got into programs, into more programs and more programs, and what happens, like we're seeing in some of the situations in Western Europe right now, is there's going to be discord. I mean, you take things away. When you give somebody something, it's like dealing with our son, right? We give him the keys to the car, but he gets the speeding tickets. He might have to sit at home. He doesn't like it, but I mean, that's the reality of life.
Right.
Maybe it's time we start dealing with that regard. And so there might be some downside. I think never, in my opinion, has there more need for industry to go back and support and augment the government, because I think they know how to do it. They're passionate about it. They're profit driven, which is fine, And I think these are the days ahead that I think it makes sense to go back and do it. Will oversight be affected by it? It shouldn't. I mean, it's not, I had a pretty good sizable staff. I know it's downsized a bit now as far as budget, and that's understandable as a result of it. Hopefully, there'll be mostly retirements, not layoffs. But I think that's reasonable to do that. Do we have to do more with less? Absolutely. But, I mean, there's creative ways to do that. It's the American dream, isn't it? I mean, business need to do more with less. And I think we can be just effective. In fact, we may be more effective than we are right now.
Right. Do you think information technology and that transparency will play a key role?
Well, I'll tell you, my opinion, those contracts out there in the IT world are the answer to this. They have to be at the table coming up with creative ideas to address these matters. There should be no reason why much of these issues could be addressed. I know in the fraud arena, we've used fraud IT programs to show anomalies in mortgage activities, and it's proven to be so advantageous for us to see red flags and see a pattern of behavior and go back and focus those matters. Those are IT-driven investigations.
Right. Well, Ken, we've reached the end of the show. It's been great. It's been fascinating. I love your story, especially about President Reagan, but also some great comments and thoughts regarding the compliance world and the mortgage industry. So I want to thank you for being on the show. Ken Donahue, Principal and Senior Advisor at the Resonant Group. You've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.